We're going to start tonight with Rav Nosson Nata Shapira. Shapira. He lived from 1585 to 1633. He was one of the very famous rabbis in Krakow.
And which years?
1585 to 1633. He lived around in and around Krakow most of his life. Most famous for a sefer he wrote called Magala Amukos. Is there a writing instrument in this? Here, right here. Let's see if one of these works.
They all work.
Let's see.
Magala? Nice. Amukos. Does anyone know what
Magala Amukos means? Magala. What's Magala mean?
Come over.
What?
Come over.
Nope.
Galut.
What?
Like Galut?
Nope.
Like
Gilui.
Dependent.
No.
No, illicit.
No. Reveal?
That was my third guess.
Revealer? Yeah, okay. So it's Amok?
Depths.
There you go. So it's Amokos?
Revealer of
Revealer
the depths.
Revealer of the depths or the hidden things.
Interesting.
Okay. So what do you think Rav Nosson Nata Shapira was doing? What type of Torah was he involved in? Kabbalah. Very good. Akbun. Very good. He was involved in Kabbalah. And he is one of the people, last time we saw, last week, we talked about the Shva, the Shem Chasapris, who's one of the people who brought the Kabbalah of the Ari to Poland and Eastern Europe. And now we're meeting the second person who did it, Rav Nosson Nata Shapira, a person who wrote a sefer called Magala Amukos. There's Magala Amukos has two svarim. One of them,
if you read Kabbalah, you're not ready for it. You're just like not going to understand it at all, right?
Basically, there's worse than not understanding it, and there's cases where you misunderstand it. And Be'ezer Hashem. End of the winter, we'll get there.
Okay.
Now, it's fascinating. Now, it's very classic, classically speaking, in terms of. You're learning funny stuff this year here. But classically speaking, a person who is competent. A person should only start working on Nistar, on the hidden Torah, after they know the revealed Torah. That's very classic. And Rav Nosson Nata Shapira, the Magala Amukos, without question, is one of those type of people. He was a well-known Talmid Chacham. He wrote Hagos, which are like, you know, comments, which are a lot of them you'll find on the Rif, which is very interesting. It's like a very interesting. I was not able find an explanation why he decided to do that. Let's see if there's a. There should be a riff. Okay. Here you go. See here you have here. Here you have here. This is a riff. See, this is the riff in the back of the Gemara.
Yeah.
This right here says Kedushah Anshei Shem, Moreno Harav Rav Nosson Shapira. That's the. Yeah, you see that?
Yeah.
Maharan Shapira. That's Rav Nosson Shapira, the Magala Mukos. It is a very fascinating and interesting thing.
Very small commentary.
Well, yeah, it's Hagos. It's Hagos. It's like small comments on the Rif and in the Iran, the Yosef, etc., the Sugya, the Bibi, the Hilch, and stuff. It's just a fascinating place for them to be. And it's just, let me finish this and you can ask your question. And it's Mashma, it seems that that's where he wrote them. In other words, some of the people, who sometimes you'll have collections of someone's statements collated and added in somewhere, and they were really written somewhere else and just applied somewhere. Rav Nosson Shapira apparently wrote his Hagos, or he wrote his comments, his little, you know, little comments on the Rif, which is a fascinating thing, because it's like the Rif already at this time, we're in the late 1500s, early 1600s, the Rif is not, he's almost like a Gemara already. Now he's not, but he's close to it. So it's fascinating. I didn't find a reason why I did it, but I'm just kind of commenting, I can't resist the comment, yeah.
That's what I was going to ask in that regard. Would you say it's better in terms of a learning style to learn the riff and then move on to actual Gemara? Like to to go through the riff, the entire shots, the riff, or as much
okay.
As much as
okay. Okay, that's a very off-topic question.
Sorry.
You want to know a person today should a person, what? How should a person relate to the riff, or how should a person use the riff?
Okay.
If you're not learning a sugya in a serious halachic sense, then the riff is not really going to help you so much. What did the riff do?
Broke it down. Just covered all the.
He took out. That's right. He wrote down the parts that he wrote. That he brings. He didn't just take it. He writes down the parts of the Gemara plus a small amount of his own commentary, which what is nogel halacha l'maisa. It's like this. Here's how I say. You say, I'll say this in yeshivish fashion. Manavshach. You know what manavshach means? Manavshach means however you're going to look at it. It means either way. It's really, you'll see what it means when I'll use manavshach here. Manavshach. If you want to learn halacha, just to know what to do. So the riff is not, it's too early. We cannot just, there are too many rishonim after the riff for you to just learn the riff, just like you can't just learn the Rambam. Because the Rambam, of course, the Rambam is the Rambam. But Lamaisa, you have to know that the X amount of time, the Rambam is not L'Halacha at all. Because we have to worry about, the Rambam, we're not saying the Rambam wasn't competent, the Rambam is very competent. But we can't just say, oh, we like the Rambam, it's not like, it's just, the Rambam was very big, but, so were Rashi, Tosus, the Rosh, etc. So, if you're asking, if you just want to learn Halacha, and you're like Kilo for whatever, everyone's not going to be able to learn Gemara all their lives. So the riff is the wrong place to do it. To learn Halacha, learn either, I'll give you a pick, depending on how serious of a job you want to do. You can do Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, there's nothing wrong with doing that. And he's not as machmer as people think he is. People think, oh, he's very machmer. He's not so machmer. You can do Chaya Adam, or you can do Mishnah Berurah. That's what you can do. Or you can do something a little later if you want. That's doing just halacha. If you want to learn Gemara, so the riff is at a later step. You're only going to learn the riff seriously if you're learning a sugya, a little bit of a serious fashion. You learn the sugya, then you learn the sugya, Gemara Rashi tells us, you can't do anything until you see Rashi tells us, then you learn the riff. Sometimes, I've done them many times, there will be places, I'm not going to diverge more to tell you about it. I could get very lost in discussing this.
Right.
The Lamdanim usually don't pay much attention to the riff for whatever reasons, but whatever, and come. Okay, so that's what I have to say. But it's fascinating that Nassim Shapira wrote on the riff. Okay. Now, one thing we could see from this, apparently, at least in my opinion, is that there was at this point in time, and there is sort of a historical machlokas about how to focus when you're learning something l'halacha.
Right.
And that is, do you focus primarily on, in other words, we're post-Tur Shulchan Aruch and what the Hasidim call Paskim. That's the era we're living in. We're after Shulchan Aruch and Paskim, as they call them. Do you focus primarily on that and you just use the sugya as a backdrop? Or you focus on the sugya and carry through? And the sugya has, what has more primacy? The sugya or the paskim, as the Chassidim called? So that's a historical machlokas. Mm-hmm. And it would appear that Rav Nassim Shapira was of the opinion that the sugya is of more primary importance. And that's why he wrote on the riff.
Right.
That's where his comments are. Because that's apparently what he held. Okay, fine. Now we have here one of the points. This is a history class, as I've been concentrating on last names, especially of Ashkenazi Achronim, because as commented, the Ashkenazi we can show that the Ashkenazi Rishonim more or less didn't have it. There was almost none of them, if not absolutely none of them, who had last names. Last name, again, in Ashkenazi circles, only became standardized in the late 1700s. Nonetheless, Reb Nassim, there are a number of exceptions, and Reb Nassim Shapira is one of them. We saw that Horovitz, and we theorized possibly Yaffe, are people who originally came from Svard, who came from Spain. We're not sure Horovitz, we know they did, or we're relatively sure they did. Yaffe may have. Shapira definitely didn't. The tradition for Shapira is a slight shortening of Ashpira. Ashpira is old Ashkenazi pronunciation of a city in the Lorraine, in Alsace-Lorraine, called Spire. Spire. It was a city, it's in one of the ecclesiastic states over there. Jews lived there for a very long time. There was a very famous massacre there in 1096 in the First Crusade.
Yeah.
Very famous massacre?
Yeah.
You heard of that? The famous massacre that we talk about in the Kinos on Tisha B'Av, and as I've said, whenever I've mentioned it, I still am in absolute shock that in this base midrash, in this building, they don't have a copy of Kinos for reference sake. Because as is well known, Rabbi Soloveitchik was very well known for using Kinos not merely to daven up on Tisha B'Av, but also as a real source of Torah. So I can't believe it. Yeah, I mean, I keep making a machla about it. Nothing ever happens. Okay. Now I'm going to tell you a very famous legend of the Reb Nosson Shapira. And I hope I heard it over. I took notes, but not the exact notes. I didn't record it, so I'm going to do the best job I can. I'm not even sure if the person who said it over completely accurately. And this famous story is one of the first known stories we have about the Jewish brothers-in-law. Okay. It's a common theme in Eastern Europe.
Jealous.
Stories of the jealous brothers-in-law. What does it mean, jealous brothers-in-law? So there was, I would call it, it's a very complicated, it's not only, it probably happened in the times of the Rishonim, but we're just too, it's, in terms of continuity, there's just too much has happened. In other words, it could be something like this happened in Spain also. It's just that the Jewish community in Spain, Jews left Spain over 500 years ago. The majority of Jews left Spain in 1391, for the records. Spain plus 1391 wasn't that big. It wasn't that small, but it wasn't that. It lost a lot of its potency after 1391. So we lost continuity in terms of popular legend of what happened in Spain. So we know that it's gone. Jews and Ashkenazi Jews were almost even Yekkes were mostly thrown out of Germany in the 1400s and 1500s. Most Ashkenazi Jews, they don't like to hear this, but they came back from Poland in the late 1500s to early 1600s. They were able to come back from Poland, Poland, Hungary, etc., etc. They were able to move back into Germany. They forgot that, but that's a fact. I mean, the famous Kihilos Ehud, Altoona, Hamburg, Wandsbek. Okay, whatever. Okay, I see that didn't ring the bell on you, but famous German kills. Those were all founded around 1600. They're not as ancient, there were places that had kind of continual communities, but they were a very small minority, and that we spoke about already. So we've lost in terms of popular folklore because, as one Jewish historian calls it, Jews on the move. Because the Jews are on the move. When you're on the move, you lose the folklore. Jews were in Poland for a long time, though. I mean, there was a significant Jewish population in Poland from 1500 all the way to 1940. So there is X amount of folklore. There's even folklore from the Ramah and the Marshal. There's folklore from them also, which is just it because it was continual. Okay. Rav Nosson Shapira and the Jealous Brothers-in-Law. So I don't know the right way to say this, and there's like a certain, tension and relationship, historically speaking, between Talmidei Chachamim, Big Talmidei Chachamim, and very well-to-do people. It's a historical tension point of sore points there. Now, contrary to common belief, the concept of supporting a son-in-law was not invented in the last 30 years, or the last 50 years. It wasn't. It's a lot more widespread today, and I'm not going to diverge. I can diverge to explain things, but not now. I don't want to get too off the topic. But there was a concept that has existed for a long time. We don't know, again, from the Rishonim, we lost connection with that, so we don't know, we have no idea. But we've had a lot of examples. The Sma was supported by his in-laws. Okay, Ramesh and Shapiro was also well known. Well, it was a star in a yeshiva, and he was supported by a well-to-do father-in-law. And again, classically speaking, the brother-in-laws were very jealous. And that's classic. There are parallel stories with the Beis Halevi and Rav Shul and Igra. I don't want to just talk about John's brothers and mother for the rest of the night, but they're classic examples. So he had jealous brothers-in-law. And of course, classically speaking, the jealous brother-in-law said, he's not such a good Talmud, he's not such a big Talmud, he's not really a scholar. This guy, he says he's always learning on his own. What's he doing on his own? People learn with chavrusas. And this guy goes out and hides out on his own all the time. He's priest from the house for a couple of days. He's all on his own. He's learning. He's learning the numbers. Where's the numbers?
No one's smart enough to be a scholar.
No, that's not what's going on. Okay, so the brothers-in-law, of course, they're apparently in this case, the brothers-in-law were married to sisters. There's three ways to be a brother. Different way, someone can marry your sister, you can marry their sister, or you can marry sisters. There's three ways to be a brother-in-law. Right? You got it? Their sister, they can marry your sister, or you can marry sisters. At least one of these brothers-in-law was co-sister. In other words, Yaakov had Rachel and had Leah. And Rachel married Ramas and Shapira. And Leah married somebody else. Got it? They're brothers-in-law. Now, we know that women talk. There's not much you can do about it. And they're not good at keeping secrets either. They're not good. Women are notorious for not being able to keep a secret. So, what happened? The brothers-in-law convinced their wives that the other brother-in-law, Russell Shapiro, is really just hiding out and, I don't know, playing chess or something like that. He's not really learning. So they convince their wives, and their wives convince their sister. So you think you're married to the Chasam Tzedek, important Talmud Chacham. It's not true. He's really just, who knows, doing what. He's really playing the stock market on the side when he's all on his own. Fine. So, fine. His wife, they bother her so much, I decided to speak to her husband about it. And he didn't really want to tell her, but she kept asking about it. He saw she was really very bothered. He says, listen, I'm going to tell you now, but you're not allowed to tell anybody.
Oh, God.
You have to keep the secret.
That's going to happen.
He says, oh, right, that's right, wait a second. She says, finally, she agrees. And he says, okay, I'll tell you something. I'm not learning on my own half of Chavrusa. My Chavrusa is Elio and Navi. But you're not allowed to tell anybody. Okay, so she's very happy, and she tries not to tell her sisters. But you know that sisters can't not talk to each other. It's not possible. So eventually she tells her sisters and tells them you're not allowed to tell anybody. But her sisters go and tell her husband, their husbands. And their husbands decide, they don't believe it. Ah, come on. That schmuckle, he's the one, you think he's learning the Leonavi? Are you serious? So they go to spy on him when he's running with supposedly Eliyahu. They spy on him and they die. Okay, so now Rav Nachman Shapiro has a big problem. He kiviyachol caused the death of his brothers-in-law. So he does something classic, which is he goes into self-imposed exile. Because as we know, if you kill someone with shogeg, we're warning Marcus, if you kill someone with shogeg, you're supposed to go into exile. He goes into exile, he's in exile here, he's in exile there. Finally, he's in a city after a number of years. He's in a city, and someone accuses him of stealing something.
Does he bring his wife with him?
No.
No.
That was common, whatever. I don't know. All those details, as we say, on a Chassidic Shemaz, my friend, Nishkin Kashas. I don't know if this is not really a Chassidic story. You don't ask questions on Chassidic stories.
No.
So this is not really a Chassidic story, but it's a similar type of folklore that you can't. I didn't see the original source. I heard it from someone who's basically an accurate person, which is why I'm willing to say it over. If I didn't think he was basically accurate, I wouldn't say it over at all. Because a lot of times people get like, it's sort of like, I don't know what it was, some guy told me over a shir he heard from somebody, And he like made like one small error. And I told him, I mean, he told it to me, I told him he's crazy. And I was, it was like pretty off. I saw the article, I saw an article written over from the Shear, someone who understood the Shear. And it was sort of like the difference between catching a fly ball and if it bounces on the floor or it bounces on the ground once.
Yeah.
Like, what's the difference? Bounce on the ground. There's a big difference. This guy's out, that guy's not. So, you know, sometimes these small details can be very important. So if a person doesn't have a real sense of accuracy, and there's some details that aren't so important. But, you know, like what their sister-in-law's names were and how their sister-in-law's is not as important. I'm theorizing that at least one of them must have been his wife's sister. Because I'm telling you right now, the girls can't not talk to their sisters. Okay, anyway, Bekitzer. He was in a town after a number of years. He was accused of stealing something, of stealing a large sum of money. And they called him into the Rav, they called him into the local rabbi. And the local rabbi starts to, he was going around like he's a beggar. Like he's a poor person. And sometimes the poor people stole things too. If you didn't give them money, they wouldn't take it. And the rabbi starts speaking to him. And he was able to see that this person is no beggar. This person is really a Talmud Chacham in exile. This is really someone of real stature. So he asked, can you tell me what's going on? It's not possible that you're really, really a beggar. There must be something going on. So Nosson Shapira saw this as a simon, it's a sign from heaven. It's time for him to end his exile. And he ended his exile and revealed the story to whatever rabbi this was. Okay. That's the famous legend of the Mount Megala Amukos. Okay, let's go on. We will go on to the Marsha. Let's hook the green as we do the green. Marsha.
Only slightly better.
I hope we know who the Marsha is. No, we know
who
Maharsha. Marsha. We know who the Marsha is. He's one of those guys in the back of the Gemara.
Yeah.
He's in the back of every single Gemara. See? Marsha. Here he is, right here. Okay.
Means Moreno Harav Shmuel Eliezer.
Harav.
Moreno or Shmuel.
Mem. Hey, Resh, Shin,
Now, he's called
Jamon Eliezer.
Shmuel.
Shmuel Eliezer.
Shmuel Eliezer, yeah. 1555 to 1632.
I went like slightly out of order because Rav Nosson Shapira, the Malgala Mukas, goes with the Shla because they're both in Kubal.
Right.
And the Marsha is back to regular stuff, so that's why he's, even though he's like slightly earlier, but doing it now. Okay. Now, he's also called Ailes.
Ailes?
Ailes. Or, depending on how you want to spell it, Ailes. Now, again, Ashkenazim don't really have last names at this time.
Right.
Okay? And that's not, that's really, it's an inaccuracy to say his last name was Adels. It wasn't. His mother-in-law's name was Adel. His mother-in-law was very well-to-do, and she supported him in a yeshiva for 20-something years. And it's really Adels. Adel's son-in-law.
Ah.
You got it? There's supposed to be an apostrophe between the L and the S.
His
mother-in-law. His mother-in-law supported him, which is fascinating. But that's why he's called Adels. His mother-in-law supported him. So it's also, I guess, this is like one of the first known examples of great Jewish businesswomen. No, there is plenty of them. Trust me, there's plenty of them. Contemporarily, we can start naming them right now. I know. Right across, if you think they're right across the board. Okay. She died in around 1604. And he was forced into Rabbanus as a result of that. He had to become a rabbi. And again, typically, I didn't even write down all the places he served. He went here, he was here, he was there, he was here, he was there. He was all over the place. Because again, the standard, as mentioned last week or the week before, the standard of, in that time, rabbis weren't given unlimited tenure. They were standardly giving 3 to 5 year contracts. And it was understood that after 3 to 5 years, unless everyone loved each other dearly, they would, move on.
Why was there so much like strife, you know, like that?
I wouldn't say there was strife. It's a hard question why that was the custom to have a 3 to 5 year contract, but that's the facts. That's historically recorded. And it's not, I'm not sure if that's, it's a good question. It's a good question. I don't have enough material to work with to say anything of real substance. Okay. Now, what's the Marsha most famous for, of course? He's most famous for his Chidushei Halachas and Chidushei Agadas. It's printed in every single shas. Marsha's Chidushim, it's almost standard in every single Gemara you buy. You can buy it without the Rif, but it's very hard to buy it without the Marsha. You can buy it without the Rif or the Rosh, but the Marsha is almost always going to be there. Right? Marsha is almost there. He has two parts of it, Chidushei Halachas and Chidushei Agadas. Now, the Marsha calls it Chidushei Halachas, but it's not Chidushei Halachas. Like, in other words, it's not like commentary on Shulchan Aruch and technically halachically oriented. It's a very, you know, spitz, very classic, stereotypical Ashkenazi statement about where halacha lies, where the meat of halacha lies. According to the classic Ashkenazi tradition, it lies in the body of the sugya of the Gemara. And the Marsha, calling his commentary Ki'il, Chidushei Halachas, shows you where the Marsha lied on this historically, you know, this historical like patterning between those where you put your emphasis, even when you're learning Halacha. Even when I'm learning Halacha, do I put my emphasis on the Sugya? Do I put my emphasis on the Poskim? As hit me, I'll tell you right now, it's what Chaim Volozhin said. Some people say, if you learn the sugya with the halacha, it's like adding spices, it's like adding pepper to gefilte fish. Got it? If you learn the sugya with the halacha, then you add pepper to the gefilte fish. So what's the gefilte fish? The halacha. And the sugya is the pepper. Rabbi Chaim Volozhin said, it's just boom, fucker! It's the opposite. You learn the sugya with the halacha, then you're adding. When you learn the sugya is the fish, right. And the halacha is the pepper ki'il. So that's a historical, you know, machlokas ki'il, going back a long time, well before the time of Russia, and we apparently could see that the Maharsha felt that the body, that the most primary part of the process is the sugya. Now, last week we spoke about the Maharav, and there's a very fundamental difference between the style of the Maharav and the style of the Marsha. I don't know how much experience you guys have with either one.
No, more with the Marsha, just because I've heard him
mention. Yeah, just because he's mentioned more in Shir, right?
Yeah.
Rabbis like the Marsha more. That's fascinating. Okay, we'll get there in a minute. There's a very fundamental difference, stylistic difference between the Marsha and the Maharav. And that is, the Maharam is written as a running commentary to Tosfos. The Maharam is written as a running commentary to Tosfos. He will explain Tosfos' question and then explain his answer. Sometimes he will ask on Tosfos' question or his answer. Sometimes, even the Maharam is primarily based around Tosfos. But the Maharsha is almost only on Tosfos. But that's not the main difference. The Maharsha is ki'ilu turning Tosfos on himself. That's not really an accurate way to say it, but I don't say it that way. Just to Tosfos, what does Tosfos do? Tosfos takes what the Gemara is doing, which is asking questions and giving answers, and applies it right back to the Gemara. That's what Tosfos does. He compares sugyas, and he does what the Gemara does. He does right back to the Gemara. Right? That's what Tosfos is doing. The Maharsha does that right back to Tosfos. He's either going to ask from the sugya, our sugya to Tosfos, are from a different sugya of Tosfos, but the style of the Maharsha, the Shaka Vataya, is similar to a Tosfos, but it's a Tosfos on a Tosfos. And again, unlike the Maharam, where the Maharam is running commentary, the Maharam is written very clearly for the records. It doesn't mean it's not deep, it's just written clearly. It's like Rashi, Ki'ilu. Okay. The Maharsha is more of a like a Tosfos on the Tosfos. Now, as we note, rabbis, for some reason or another, seem to like the Maharsha more than the Maharam. Yeah, but the Maharam is pertinent to the Tosfos, so the question is why? Why is it true? That's not an old thing, it's not a new thing. This is an old, age old, the Chidah says over 200 years ago, 250 years ago, that he heard that the Rabbanim, he heard that the rabbis of Pummel really liked the Maharsha a lot. He says, you're right, 250 years ago. The Rabbanim in Poland are wild over the Maharsha. Why is that true? Why is that true? Okay, so here's what I have to say about it. There's two things. One is the Maharam is much more limited. It's a much more limited sefer. It's heavy at the beginning of Masechtos, and on quotes the more popular parts, but it's not as spread out. Once you get off that Beis or Gimel, there's not that much Maharam. Some Masechtos look for a little longer, but the Maharam is not as spread out over the entirety of the Masechta. The Maharsha is much more key, much more consistent, going from Masechta Yidim, also strong on everything, Mitchila from beginning till the end. There's another point like this. You can not understand the Tosfos well, and think you understand the Tosfos well, and think you're understanding the Maharam. Because it's sort of like Rashi. I know plenty of people who try to tell me Rashi. Rashi wrote Ki'ilu too smoothly. So smoothly, you cannot understand Rashi, and still think you understand Rashi. Okay? Tosfos is varied. Usually you don't really understand the Tosfos unless you think, but I mean, there are plenty of Tosfos you cannot understand and think you're understanding. The Ramban, for example, is so difficult that you don't understand it until you really understand it, more or less, much more than less. The Maharsha is similar to that. The Maharsha, the minimal, the beginning level of the Maharsha starts pretty high up. And as people say, if you don't understand the Maharsha, you probably didn't understand Tosfos to begin with. So for better or for worse, rabbis like that idea. We want to see if it's considered as part by the world at large, as like a litmus test and a depth test on how well you have Tosfos down. So that's why the Maharsha is very, very important. Now, it's also a fact, it's historically true, that throughout the Doros, from the ages, again, the Chidah says it, but I don't even need the Chidah. I can show you from Dalai Abronim, if the Maharsha talks about something, they're all going to talk about it. Panei Yeshua is going to talk about it. Hamdashah, they're all going to talk about it. All the Dalai Abronim are going to talk about it. The Maharsha says something, that's almost defined where the sugya lies today. That's how great of an impression the Maharsha made on learning of sugyas. That's a major issue. The other part of the Maharsha is the Shekhanos. We'll get back to it more in, I think, 2 weeks. I don't know if we'll get there next week. Get back to it more in 2 weeks. But it's actually impossible to know. Again, the Maharsha's dates, 1555 to 1632, this is the beginning of the modern world. This is early modern, and one feels, even though you can't absolutely prove it, that the beginning of new enlightenment, neo-rationalism, has hit the world. And part of the reason why the Maharsha wrote Chidush HaGadlus is probably as a response to that, even though I can't absolutely prove this. Even though it can't be mamish proven, there are a quote here and there which is very strongly leads one to believe that. I didn't have time to look back over his Hakdama. The Maharsha wrote a preface to his work. If I would have time to do that, then I could have probably, it's probably provable from there. It's printed in Brachas. That it was probably a partial response to those who look at Agadita as similar to mythology, etc., etc., etc. Maharsha is very important. very important in understanding Agatha. It's a very difficult and highly controversial topic. Would to take Agatha literally. I spoke about it 2 years ago when I gave a shiur on the Rambam. And if I give next year, I think next year I'm going to say on the Rambam's, I'm going to start out with the Rambam's Akhtama to Pirkei Avos, Shemot Prakim, and I'll probably speak about it next year also, much more at length. Very controversial topic. And the Marsha, people, but they, whatever. The Marsha, you know, weighed in his opinion, and that he's a little more traditional. Kiyulu, the Maral, Kiyulu, these things. There's no question. There's no question in all of it that the Marsha is very important in terms of understanding what the Agadita means, and in terms of determining how we, you know, how we look at it. Okay. Fighter, let's go. I hope we can get through the Marit today. Okay, the Marit. There's a reason I'm doing the Marit also. I'm sure you haven't heard. Have you heard of the Marit? No, I didn't think. I'll do an informal poll here. I'll be surprised if many people heard. I don't even know the number who knows who the Marit is. Okay, Mim stands for?
Harina.
Harav.
Yitzchak. Yaakov.
Yosef. Oops.
Tov.
Trani. Harav, Yosef, Trani.
He has a last name?
Yes, he does. Ooh. What does that mean?
Svartik.
Excellent. Actually Italian, but whatever. The same thing, more or less the same idea. He was, his family was originally from Italy. Which is why his last name is Trani, and he's descended from the Tosfos Rid, whose last name is Din Trani, of Trani. His name was Min Trani, from Trani. Okay, the Marit was born in 1568 in Tzfat. His father was the Mavit.
Something Binyamin Trani?
Moshe Ben Yosef Trani.
So he's named after his grandfather.
He's named after his grandfather, that's right. He was born in 1568 in Tzfat. His father was the Mabit. The Mabit was one of the big Rabbanim in Tzfat in the golden era of Tzfat, which that's why we're doing the Marit to see how the golden era finishes off. The golden era of Tzfat is from like 1530 until about 1590. And the Marit is the tail end of the golden era. He was born 1568 in Tzfat. He lived the first approximately 20 years of his life in Tzfat. He married a descendant, I would guess, granddaughter or great-granddaughter of the Beis Yosef, of the Mechaber Shulchan Aruch, which is very fascinating, because his father, the Mabit, was known for arguing with Rabbi Yosef Karo, with the Mechaber, with the author of Shulchan Aruch. But that just goes to show you a Zavoy of Masupa. That means when you fight someone in Torah, it doesn't mean you hate him. Means you come to love him. So it's fascinating that the Marit married a descendant, probably a granddaughter or great granddaughter of the Beis Yosef of the Mechaber Shulchan Aruch. Now, his adult life, which starts in around 1590, there was a lot of difficulties, turmoil. One of the constants back in the old days was plague. Plague was a big problem. Everyone knew if there's a plague, you need to get out of there. Right. Because they understood that plagues are, you know, dangerous. So he had to leave Tzfat a number of times because of plagues. The other problem was, is this is a little after the golden era of the Ottoman Empire. And the Ottoman Empire, as mentioned, I believe last week or the week before, has slightly descended into anarchy. Not complete anarchy, but this is the era of the Pashas. That the local governors, who were called Pashas, had a little too much power. So he became in 1590, the rabbi of Tzfat. And the rabbi back in those days was given one of the hardest jobs that you could give him. Which
judging.
Was? What?
Judging?
No, much more difficult than that. Difficult job.
Easter slap?
Collecting the taxes. How's that? I said it was a difficult job, didn't I? That's one difficult job.
Why would the rabbi be collecting taxes?
Why would the rabbi collect taxes? Because the rabbi was a communal official. He was the chief of the leader of the community. And as a result, the pasha felt that the rabbi has to collect taxes. And that meant that they can't pay. The pasha wanted a lot of tax money.
Yeah.
We're not talking about modern world with accurate bookkeeping, etc., etc. We're talking about, he said he needs a lot of money. Jews are rich, right?
Yep.
Absolutely. Get me a lot of money. Fine. So the rabbi was in a tough position. And if he couldn't get the taxes in his city, he had to go get it somewhere else. So the Lapid traveled at least twice to Constantinople.
To collect money from other Jews.
To collect money from other Jews. There you go. To collect money from other Jews. To help the Jewish community in Sfat. Eventually, in 1604, he was offered by a very well-to-do family whose name is given as Ibn Ya'ish in Constantinople. He was given an offer he can't refuse to stay in Constantinople.
What?
He was given an offer he can't refuse. According to Rabbi Yaakov Emden, Yaakov Emden's father was a Chacham Tzvi, who even though he was Ashkenazi, he went to Constantinople, he learned in Istanbul, Constantinople, a Chacham Tzvi, Rabbi Tzvi Ashkenazi, he learned in Istanbul, Constantinople, and he heard that the Ibn Ya'ish brothers offered the Mabi half of their entire fortune to stay in Constantinople. Wow, that's serious. That goes to show you, as I said many times, Spartans know how to treat rabbis. That's what I've said many times about it. Fine. He mainly left over Shilas and Shuvas. The reason why we went through the Marit here is because the Marit is like, he's born in Sfat in the end of its golden era, and his life sort of like corresponds to the, like, in total, and after the Marit, there are no major, nothing major is happening in Sfat for a long time. Like, you know, there's that, like, burst of glory in the 1500s. And after post-1600, post-Marit, Sfat is basically quiet. So that's why we went through the Marit, even though we never heard of it. But he mainly wrote Shilas and Tshuvas, which, of course, are very important and substantial. They say he wrote Kiddushin on most of Shas. We only have on Kiddushin Ksuvas in the beginning of Shabbos. He's not quite as, quote, what I call Achronish as the Marsha. In other words, the Marsha is interested in one thing, understanding Tosfos Ki'ilu. Of course, you can't understand Tosfos unless you understand the Gemara Rashi also. But the Marsha is absolutely concentrating, if not 95%, at least 90% of Marsha is written straight on Tosfos. The Mabit is not quite as much. It's not as, quotes, Achronish. You know, he's not going to go, the Marsha is really bigger, primarily interested in how to understand Tosfos. The Marit is not that, you know, concentrated on Tosfos, but again, at the end of the day, he's even though he's an early Achron, he's still an Achron, and he's not going to contest Tosfos head to head. He can't really do it. But his style, his condition is not quite as what I call Achronish as the Marsha. On the other hand, Arishin, Rishonim, are commentaries straight on Shas, and that the Marit isn't either. Okay, let's see anything else. I think that they say he wrote Kiddushim on the Rif, but they were lost by that kind of class. See you next week.